So, you organize closets for a living.
Yes.
Is it hard to find people who can't organize their own closets? I mean, how does that work?
Well, it's not that they can't do it for themselves, it's that they don't have the time or they don't do it efficiently.
Did you start with organizing glove compartments and then just like work your way up from there? Or listen, I'm sorry. I know this is not going well. I haven't been on a date in 20 years.
I haven't been on a date since senior year.
Oh, were you married in college?
Yeah.
Me too.
Really?
Yeah. Is this not the weirdest feeling in the world right now?
Like Weird Al starring in Weird Science.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. I'm your host, Devin Decker, and joining me, my co-curator in our journey into the cinematic universe of Adam Sandler, Sejan Serowik. Sejan?
Hello, Devin, and thank you for introducing us so well once again, bringing us into this cinematic experience with the kind of candor I think it really deserves. This low key kind of just chill vibe throughout the rest of the movie is really what we should expect, I believe.
Yes, this is a notable episode, because while we've already been to Europe and Hawaii, which I know is just part of North America, this is the first time in our journeys that we venture to the continent, the cradle of life, where it all began. We're going to Africa, buddy!
Yeah, and I'm wearing the whitest tie I own because fuck me if this was not the whitest movie I've ever seen.
Well, it's South Africa. They go to South Africa. They sneak it in there. Hi, welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Again, I'm Devin Decker. He's Sejan Serowik. Welcome to the show. We're glad to have you as we continue our second season with the theme of Adamand
Yeah.
and.
And I apparently continue my ongoing fight against what I hope is not
I mean,
COVID.
at this point, I think if it were COVID, you'd hopefully
Yeah,
know,
sure. Yes, I
right?
know. I can't
Maybe
be
it's
tested otherwise,
malaria.
so.
Did you swallow anything while you were up there parasailing over the land? I don't.
Notice this movie very actively avoided the topic of vaccines.
Yeah, that's weird. He says like don't get malaria, but I'm pretty sure you need a malaria vaccine if you're going to Africa. I
I
think it's
like
just
dimes, man.
required. But hi, welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. This episode sees us wrap up Adam and Drew Barrymore, their trilogy of films.
For now.
They're what?
I mean, I could definitely see them at some point coming back together after the three we've watched, including today's. We'll talk more about that
Yeah,
later.
no, I actually, there was the thought in my mind as I watched this film was, I'm ready for them to do a fourth. Where's round four? And honestly, what I would really like, right? We're just spitballing here. This is not about Blended. This is about my love of Adam Sandler and the universe that we explore each month here on the show. I would love it if Murder Mystery Tour 2
Yes.
introduced a Prince and the Pauper-esque element where he has a doppelganger out there, and that doppelganger is married to Drew Barrymore.
And they're the murderers. Wouldn't that be amazing that there was an evil, like, couple version of him and Jennifer Aniston, and it's him and Drew Barrymore?
Think that would be awesome. I think, Adam, we're available to write it. I mean, I know you're gonna end up going over it with Alan Covert and Tim Herlihy and the whole gang, but this what you can have this right here. Just give us a story or original idea by, because I think it would be awesome. I think it would be fantastic if the whole movie is he's kind of jealous of the guy who looks like him but has a better life and the better wife because she's like fun all the time. She's not kind of stuck up the way Jennifer Aniston is. And then as it turns out, they're the ones killing everybody.
Yeah. Oh man. Oh fuck. Yeah. That's a movie I would watch again. You know what might not be?
Is it blended?
Yeah, man. Okay. So first impression times, right? Is that where we are in the
Well,
formal? I mean.
before we go into our first impressions, let's just take a brief second for station identification, remind everybody why we're here. A year ago at this point, right now, 13 months ago, there are 13 months if it's a year plus one, Hubie Halloween came out and everybody decided, oh, what if there's an Adam Sandler cinematic universe? And honestly, it was a good question. And it was a question that Cijin and myself got asked many, many times by our friends and relations and strangers on the street. So we decided that we would just cut through the bullshit, go through Adam Sandler's impressive, expansive work, and determine our very own Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Every time you tell this story, I imagine that the one guy on the street was definitely Steve Buscemi playing a homeless dude, right?
Yeah, I mean, if we're now part of the universe, right?
Right, we've worked ourselves into existence. Like
it was his character from Big Daddy.
Willed ourselves into that movie, yeah.
Like, no, well, or he willed himself into the real world because they needed us to save the universe. We're like the saviors of the universe. We're going to come in and we're going to lay down the law so that they can figure out who belongs and who doesn't belong, because the League of Evil Adam Sandler villains are just
wreaking
havoc. Does
that make us more Green Lanterns or Watchers? Where do we fall on that?
It kind of feels like we're Watchers, yeah. But I don't know about you. I haven't taken any solemn oath not to interfere. This sounds like the time where we interfere and we realize, oh, we probably should never do that again. Because, the Watchers used to be the doers. And then they decided, oh, we can't be doing this. Let's just watch and see what happens.
Yeah.
But right now, we are still watching. We are still cultivating our very own star charts of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And that's where we are. That's what we're doing. So we're here. We finally got to Blended. We've been looking at the movies where it's Adam and a female co-star. It's been exciting stuff. And I'm happy to be at Blended because it's a movie that's important to me. But before we go into why it's important to me, I think first impressions, or second first impressions, 50 first impressions, if you will, because I've seen this movie a bunch of times. The first thing I have to say, and I'm sorry if I'm stepping on your toes here, is how was Adam Sandler able to get Michael Buscemi for this film? Noted brother of Academy Award nominated actor Stephen Buscemi.
Jeez, I wonder. How could they possibly have ever met? Yeah, man. It was nice to see him really kind of reaching into that family grab bag, which was really kind of a big element in this movie.
My favorite part about that moment, and I'm way out of order with that, is that it felt like the guy they got to play, I believe Wendy McLovin-Covey calls him Bargain Basement Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
Is that he kind of felt like the store brand Matthew Glaive. And then you have store brand Steve Buscemi, and then I look it up and I'm like, oh, it's actually Michael Buscemi. It's literally store brand Steve Buscemi. But it's one of those store brands where, like,
Randy Quaid, every dentist, man. That's how it works.
But it's like Insignia, where, like, Insignia is the Best Buy brand, but it's still an LG TV in there. We just call it Insignia and we can mark it down because the only bottom line that's affected is our own.
Is this what you focused on the entire time?
No, I mean, I focused on a lot of different things. The issue with this film, and my first impression of it, is I don't give a shit about this movie until 52 minutes into it.
And what happens 52 minutes into this movie that makes you care all of a sudden?
52 minutes into the movie, Drew Barrymore takes Adam Sandler's youngest daughter, Lou, to the restroom. Mm-hmm. And it's the first moment in the movie that I care about at all. That, like, feels like a real moment, or feels like any sort of, like, actual development of the plot or what is going on in the film. Like,
yeah.
And the weird thing about it is what I have been wrestling with since I floated above the movie for the first 51 minutes, and then the 52nd came, and then I was hooked. It had me at minute 52, and it held on to me for the rest of the film. But I wondered, is the only reason why it has me as well as it does because of all the world building they did in the first 51 minutes? And I still, I have to bring it to you, because I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if It's just that the 52-minute mark, they decided we have to tell a story?
Just to contextualize a little bit more, though, talk to me a little bit about your history with this movie, because there is some context we have to bring to the table with this movie for both of us. And I believe that this is a movie that you you once told me you finished in theaters, turned to, I don't think I'm speaking out of school when I say this, Dale, when you saw this with, and I believe the words you used to describe this film were, "That was stupid," as you sat there in tears.
Yeah. Stupid movie. And then she also said stupid movie, and a cinematic tradition in the Decker family was born, where if a movie makes us cry, and it's not specifically what this movie represents, because what Blended represents is a very unique animal at the end of the day. But if it's a movie that I wasn't expecting to end up in tears during... Which, that's what Blended is to a T. And I'm crying when the end credits roll. We look at each other and we just go, stupid movie. Because, like, you stupid movie, you made me care.
So you saw this in theaters. Your first impression of it was that you definitely had some criticisms, but at the end of the day, you felt emotionally engaged enough to shed a tear at the end of it. All of this is pretty valid. And I won't say that I vary too much from that. But this is not a movie that I went out of my way to see. I think I talked about the last time when we mentioned this is what we were doing, that this is a movie that I have seen bits and pieces of many times, planes, trains, automobiles, you know, that sort of thing. I've seen it
on your
TBS.
Way to Africa.
and so I watched it a few days ago and I was just like, all right, this movie is exactly what I thought it was. I definitely have some things about it. We're going to talk about some things today. I see why it's heavily criticized. I see why there are some people out there that still talk about it as, like, not one of the best, but one of the ones that, if you're watching Adam Sandler movies, there's worse ones you could put on, I guess would be the attitude generally I've heard about this movie. But man, I rewatched it today and I had to watch it muted because I was at work. So I threw the closed captions on, threw it up on the TV on the other side of the room, and I got to work, right? And I found myself watching some of the more upsetting scenes that I started to realize more and more were genuinely upsetting because of a lot of the weird accent work that's on display. And it's not even that it's not genuine. It's that it is put on display in a way that is upsetting, like, as a viewer. So to watch it on mute, there were some scenes in this movie that completely changed for me. And so that was a weird experience. But yeah, this is genuinely a movie that, like, I really kind of watched for the first time in the last week, and then rewatched today half-assed. And I sit here not sure how I feel about the movie, but really, really, really confident in our conversations that we've had in the past about where Sandler currently stands on things. Like, and not just like, and when I say that, I don't mean stand on things in terms of like how Sandler himself comes out and is in the world, because he is a rather reclusive dude for the kind of guy that he is. But more than that, the ways that the world views him. And this movie is like the poster child for the way that anybody talks about Adam Sandler nowadays. The ways in which, like, race in this movie is treated, the way gender in this movie is treated, the way humor in this movie is treated, is all of the stuff that, like, somebody says they don't like about Sandler, and you can't really argue with, because here it is, man. If anybody ever wants to, like, tell us that what we're doing is pointless, they could point at this movie, and I'd have a hard time continuing the conversation.
So I'm going to highlight something that I wrote in my notes right here, because everything you're saying about, like, weird accent choices, the movie itself has this moment where it is denounced. And I wasn't expecting that. And I had to rewind it and watch it a couple of times to, like, realize that, first of all, I love, and I might say this wrong, Abdoulaye Ngoumé, who ends up playing Mfana in this movie. Yeah. And we know him as the doctor from Grandma's Boy. And I think he also plays the priest in That's My Boy, which I haven't seen yet, so I can't speak of it with any sort of knowledge. But I know him as Nescobar Loplop from My Name is Earl. And I loved him on My Name is Earl. He was like this background character who ended up having this deeper story as that show progressed. And then seeing him in Blended, it was the second thing that I had ever seen him in next to Grandma's Boy. And the moment that I'm speaking of is when it is the first family dinner where the exposition dump happens that, surprise, everybody here is a mixed family. Not mixed, a blended family. They use the word blended 100 times. So it's stepmother, stepfather, stepchildren.
Mixed means something else entirely.
Yeah, exactly. Well. So, especially in a movie set in Africa. So I apologize for that. But it is. It is, like, that's the thing. And Terry Crews, who... I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong, is kind of the largest offender in terms of, like, difficult, upsetting accent work.
I mean, the phrase that gets thrown around about a lot about this movie, and again, it's not one that I can argue with, and nor would I, is the idea that it is at moments a minstrel show. And when you talk about Terry Crews, that is going to be kind of example number one. Yeah.
Right. So it's that moment where he's like, he takes off his jacket and he says, "My strong African arms are exposed." And there's a close up on Ngome and he just goes, "No, no." And that no, like, as much as it's supposed to be, "I don't like that you just took off your jacket and now you're like pimping yourself out as a sexy beast, the guy who works for me."
Mm-hmm.
It is also... It feels so, so much like him being like, "No, I can't allow this. Why am I here? I denounce it right now. Please do not judge me for what is happening in this movie."
Yeah, it feels more like he's denouncing the movie than it is him trying to, like, make a point. Like,
the movie
never does itself the justice of calling into question what is going on here. Because... there is a level of argument to be made about the idea here, the way that I have to, like, struggle to, like, make this point. So, like, I don't agree with this. But there is an argument that can exist, let's say, where this movie is trying to make a point about these ideas of these, like, these resort vacations being super problematic in and of themselves. The fact that they put this kind of stuff on display. They create this, like, cultural tourism that is... upsettingly problematic in a lot of ways, and this could be said all around the world, but the problem with that is the movie never makes that point. And I am struggling here because I don't want to give too much of my hand away here, but there's also something to be said about how there's a large chunk in this movie, and it's funny that you pointed out that it takes about 50 minutes for you to even click in, because it means you skip right over kind of one of the big things here, that there's a large chunk of this film that doesn't need to exist, a huge plot point that really doesn't add anything to the larger romance or anything, really kind of nothing that really it's nothing is added to the character development in any way. And it is the fact that they go to Africa. So all of this really problematic shit about the ways in which Africa is portrayed in this movie, you can say, like, "Oh, well, you know, that's because they're in a resort and that's the way that they," and it's just like, yeah, except that it's never addressed and it doesn't do anything for the rest of the movie. The fact that they go to Africa doesn't need to happen. Doesn't need to exist. Tell me what in this movie really changes if they don't end up just going to, like, fucking Maine to go stay on, like, an island right off the coast of New England that is reclusive. So they don't see anybody else. It's just them stuck on an island together.
To possibly show my hand for a later segment of the show, they could have just as easily gone to a resort in the Catskills as a resort on the plains of Africa.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, gotten the same experience.
I would even argue this is the same kind of thing that we kind of found ourselves in 51st Dates, where we talked about Hawaii and the idea of being like, why are they in Hawaii? Because it really just kind of adds a lot of problematic elements to the set dressing and does nothing to the actual story. Yeah. And we'll get more into that, though, I think, once you actually talk to us a little bit about this plot.
Yes. So there's the first impressions. Let's dive into the synopsis, because it's clear that Sijin and I both have a lot to say about this one. But here's the story of a man named Friedman who was bringing up three very lovely girls. Two of them had pageboy cuts, like Prince Valiant, the youngest one blonde curls. Here's the story of the lovely Lauren, who was busy with two boys of her own, energetic Tyler and horny Brandon. Dad's cheating broke their home. And then one night the two went out on a blind date to Hooters, cause Jim's classy like that, my friend. Both of them had a truly awful time. So tell me, how when will these families ever blend? Once again, reuniting Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore, Blended tells the story of widower and father of three, Jim Friedman, and divorcee and mother of two, Lauren Reynolds. They initially meet on the blind date from hell and are happy, thinking that that will be the end of it. However, fate has other plans. So when Lauren's business partner, Jen, breaks up with Jim's boss, Dick, a week before they're scheduled to go on a trip to Africa, Dick, of the sporting goods empire, does what any good one percenter would do with a non-refundable trip and sells it, at a loss, to both Jim and Lauren. Once the two clans have arrived in Africa, they realize the nefarious actions of the billionaire, and that they are essentially stuck in a family vacation together. A fact exacerbated when Lauren realizes that Dick had planned to propose to Jen during the trip, essentially making it a family moon. Somehow, even worse, everyone who is booked at the hotel for the week is there to celebrate blended family moons, so they will be forced to just go with it and pretend to be the Theodopoulos family to keep up appearances. While the parents may not be thrilled about the situation, their children are another story completely. Jim's youngest daughter, Lou, takes to Lauren immediately and is happy to get to experience what it's like to have a mother again. Espen, the middle child, is allowed to learn that even if her father were to meet someone new, that doesn't mean it will erase the memories of her deceased mother, especially since Lauren is more than willing to be there for her, but also respects the world she's constructed for herself to grieve. Finally, his oldest, Hillary, whom he affectionately calls Larry, is happy to be able to get an actual woman's perspective as she blossoms into one herself. Meanwhile, Lauren's sons are finally getting to revel in having a male role model in their lives who actually shows up. Jim helps teach her youngest Tyler to properly play baseball and learn to control his emotions, while also showing her oldest Brandon that society's toxic examples of masculinity are not the only way to prove he is a man. As it turns out, the fastest way to someone's heart is through their kids. But will that be enough for them to risk taking a second chance on true love?
Man, I had to mute myself because I almost started crying. Oh, thank you for that. Oh my God.
You're welcome. I think. I don't know.
No. That's one for the history books, my friend. Yeah. There's a lot that goes on in this movie. So adding to that, the whole family moon trip thing, and like the conceit that they're in a place where their families get forced together, totally on board for that. You know, that's just good family fun comedy tropes, right? But why does it need to be this place that they go to is highlighted so much in the activities that they do in the background of every scene that they're in, but it adds nothing. There is nothing important about them being in this specific area of the world to the plot moving forward. And all it does is serve as just a springboard for just terrible jokes and frankly, just offensive characters. They're like this is the thing where this is the movie where I feel like I don't know if this is the first movie where it shows up, but it's the first movie we've explored where the toxicity of this type of movie, and I don't just mean Sandler movies, that's why I'm not quite just blaming it all on him, but he is an example of it, but this toxicity of this type of comedy is just on full display. And like I said, it's not much different than what we saw in 50 First Dates, but something that happened between 50 First Dates and this movie where the rest of the world kind of caught on, because they just didn't stand for it this time around. And I don't know. I can't point to exactly what it is, but this is definitely the first time we've encountered it on this show.
So I'd like to go back to that I saw this in theaters. I'd like to just give the proper dressing of that set, because it's not like, oh my God, I have to go see Blended in theaters. Because if you've listened to me on this show, there was a time where I wasn't really seeing Adam Sandler movies. And honestly, the last Adam Sandler movie that I saw before Blended well, on it, like in theater, not even in theater, like, but sat down and watched was Eight Crazy Nights. And that'll be a movie that we talk about sometime on this show. But Eight Crazy Nights was kind of the last one that, like, I'm here for the Adam Sandler of this movie. And then when I worked for Carnival Cruise Lines, one of the guys on the staff, the entertainment staff, was like, "You've never seen You Don't Mess with the Zohan. We have to watch it right now." And I watched it and was kind of like, okay. And then when I got back from the cruise, I had mentioned watching it and not getting it. And the people I was friends with on land at the time were like, "What do you mean you didn't understand You Don't Mess with the Zohan? We're watching it right now." So like I had stumbled into these two groups of people who like that was a pinnacle for them of comedy and Adam Sandler, and I wasn't there for it. And then Blended, I had gone to a meeting where I was devalued by the company I was working for at the time. Like I had been working for them for about 2 years, and I had completely turned around how the office I was in worked. And then they completely devalued me and put me there. And my manager, like, she saw how angry I was, and she caught me in the parking lot and said, "You should take the rest of the day off. 'Cause if you don't, you're gonna do something stupid." 'Cause, like, it was like, "Burn it all to the ground. I'm mad as hell and I'm not gonna take it anymore," was how I felt.
Just for timeline reference, and I made sure to verify this before I dropped it. Don't Mess with the Zohan is 6 years before Blended, so we are talking a good almost half a decade, more than half a decade.
Yeah. So what I did, rather than lose my temper at the job I was working at, was to drive down to the Dirt Theater in East Providence and do a triple feature. And I saw Nonstop, Noah, and then Blended in
Jesus.
that order.
You didn't have a good day at the movies at all, did
It was exactly what I needed to just, life is absurd, so why am I trying to play by someone else's rules? Look at the movies I just watched for $6 total. So it's not like Blended was one of those, but I will say, in seeing Blended, it kind of made me remember that there was something about Adam Sandler that I liked. And it was that fact that even though this movie is, well, this movie, in no uncertain terms, it still left me feeling the way that I felt at the end of it. And that's why I saw Hotel Transylvania on DVD to see the sequel and Pixels, and really haven't missed a theatrically released Adam Sandler film since. The last one being Uncut Gems. So it's just one of those situations where, like, I know I saw it in theaters, and in a weird way, it sort of helped save me as a human being. But all of that said, it does not excuse the fact that there is just a running gag of Drew Barrymore, like, unintentionally abusing her son by hitting his head into things as she carries him to bed.
Gee, oh my God, that scene in the hallway started to get to be like upsetting to my stomach to watch.
It's like, okay, so like in the house, it's like, okay, well, like you weren't expecting to be carrying him in, right? He threw a tantrum at the ballpark, and then he tucked himself out and you need to bring him up to bed. But then at the hotel, it's upsetting, upsetting, upsetting. And then she drops him, and I'm just like, is this kid okay? And then they have the audacity to have a callback joke to it where he's like, "Yeah, why is he wearing a helmet? You're gonna carry him to bed again?" Like, no, it's not funny. Unintentional or not, that's abuse of a child.
Yeah, and that's kind of what happens throughout, right? Is there's a joke that when it comes on screen, it doesn't quite work, and they seem to know it's not working, and rather than back away from it or do anything about it, or God forbid, cut it from the movie, is they double down on it time and time and time again. This movie is just doubling down on problematic, upsetting joke after problematic, upsetting joke. when we are not the only ones that feel this way, I guess this is a good time for me to really kind of get into things like the reviews and things like this. You're talking about a movie that is one of the lowest reviewed of Sandler's whole oeuvre. I mean, we're talking about a 1.5-star review from RogerEbert.com, I think, at this point. I don't think that Roger Ebert alive had passed at this point. I mean, it's holding a 15% critic rating on Rotten Tomatoes, but this is one of those ones where then you do have to look over at the audience rating and see that it is sitting at a 65%. So, like, you know, there is a group of people out there that, again, I think feel a lot like us, where, like, this is definitely a movie that exists, and, like, it's not a bad way to waste an hour, 2 hours of your life, but it's also not the preferred way, right? I don't know. It's really weird. As far as, like, budgets and stuff go, I mean, you're talking about Sandler and Drew Barrymore being your two biggest paychecks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is just butter. They go to a resort that I'm sure is an actual resort in some fashion, and then it's
a Sunlight Resort in South Africa.
Yeah, and then they just hang out for 2 weeks and film a movie. Like, it's as easy as cake. So we're talking about a $40 million budget, which, again, I'm sure the bulk of both of that goes to the two of them, right? And then, like, it ends up making in the U.S. alone $46 million. And, like, you know, you start taking in worldwide and it's a bona fide, you know, moneymaker. It's not a slouch in any way. Like, his performance numbers are what they are. But, again, I think this just becomes the kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? The stereotypical Sandler movie? Stereotype's not the right word, because there's plenty of stereotypes in this movie, and that's not one of them.
It becomes the gold standard.
In the shit pile. Like,
right, exactly. But it's
the gold turd standard.
Yes, that's good. It becomes that gold turd standard. It is. What I was reminded of watching this film is how everybody talks about Little Nicky. Where everybody's like, Little Nicky is just the greatest hits. And it's like, Blended is truly, truly just the greatest hits.
Yeah, but it feels like it's the greatest hits of movies I never saw. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like, oh yeah, that's a joke I should have seen in a Sandler movie before, but I couldn't tell you which one. As opposed to Little Nicky, where that kind of vibe comes up from time to time, but it is legitimately like, oh, that's Gilmore. Oh, that's, you know, that's Billy Madison. You know what I mean? Like,
well, the difference is at that point, Little Nicky comes out and I think there are 6 movies for it to draw from. And at this point, there's at least 20 for it to draw from in terms of its referential things. Yeah. But it also, and we'll get to it when we get to New Old Borrowed Blue, is it reaches as far back as his early stand-up. With things that he's referencing.
Yeah.
That I don't even know. It's a little crazy, this film. Like, it's just about having fun. And on the one hand, I'm okay with that. But on the other hand, I understand why people saw this movie and developed a very unique perspective on the types of film that Adam Sandler was producing and bringing
again
to the table.
This is the first one that we have watched. I won't claim that it's the first one in his history, because we haven't really dove into it enough yet for me to make that claim. But it is the first one that we have come across where, yes, the humor is all in good fun, but this is the first time that it feels truly toxic. It feels truly like, okay, this is not fun on an upsetting level. Like, somebody out there is going to be offended by this in a reasonable way that is going to make them not want to be in the group anymore. You know what I mean? Like, watching Little Nicky and being offended by, like the fact that there's boobs on screen. First of all, they're there for 2 seconds. And secondly, like, it feels like if that's not something you could buy into, then you're not going to buy into the rest of this movie. This movie feels straight up just like, we don't want you to buy in. Like, you're kicked out of the room. And if you can't get this, like, you're not welcome. Like, it feels so uninviting. And that's the first time that I have said that about any of these movies that we have watched.
Little Nicky is sort of a celebration of everything that came before it. It's why, if you go back and listen to it, I feel like he's telling kind of a personal story with that film in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
This one feels a little gatekeeper-y. It feels like either you're a part of this joke or you're not part of the joke. And if you're not part of the joke, why are you even here?
Well, and part of it has to be that the difference between the place that he's in making Little Nicky and now, it's not just number of movies under his belt. It's literally how much money the guy has, right? Like, this is also the kind of the first time that we're really kind of addressing some of this problematic humor from a guy that's in a really powerful position as opposed to who he was in the early 90s when he was doing Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, right? Like, he's not just the kid from SNL being the bad boy of comedy on screen anymore. He's a guy that we know. I mean, straight up, he's made funny people by this point. Right. He's made jokes himself about himself being the guy that has, like, the house with the pool so big that, like, he could drown on one end and nobody would find him for days, like, that kind of shit. Like, and so to be in that position in the world and to be a rich white American male and then to go to Africa in your movie for no reason except to have a bunch of shitty African jokes feels really kind of ignorant. And it's the first time his comedy feels completely ignorant.
You know what is the first time that it is? It's the first time that we're not watching every man as our heroes. And I extend that to Drew Barrymore as well, because in Brandon's bedroom is a full-size arcade Star Wars pinball machine.
Yeah. No, it's completely out of touch. They want us to believe that these are just regular folks, and then that kind of shit is on screen, and they don't realize it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's not on purpose. They literally think this is what parents buy for their kids on a regular basis. And Drew Barrymore, we should address in the same breath, is no slouch in this department. We're talking about it like a self-made woman here who, like, she has a daytime TV show now. She has a publishing company.
I mean, say self-made. She comes from one of the oldest acting families in Hollywood.
I mean more about the fact that she is basically Oprah now.
Because there's plenty
of people out there that come from those families and we don't hear from them. But she is, like, front and center.
I mean, her story is a story of redemption. She was, like, so far down the booze and drugs tunnel.
In terms of the out-of-touch mom, right? Like, the out-of-touch boomer aspect of it. She is just as guilty as Sandler is what I'm trying to get at. Like, I don't doubt for a second that Adam Sandler is like, yeah, you buy your kid an arcade machine because you love him. And she was just like, of course I did. And there's never a moment where anybody was like, humans don't do that, guys. Like, you're the reason we think lizard people run Hollywood. What are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, it's also, I just don't know about that sort of stuff. Like, he manages a Dick's Sporting Goods, and to the fact that he can just call up the owner of the entire chain and be like, hey, let me buy that Africa trip from you.
Yeah.
And also, like, first of all, I here's where Adam Sandler loses me as a character in this. This is the first time, and we've watched a bunch of these movies, where he seems to understand anything about the travel industry. Because he's like, oh, we're just gonna have to cancel the trip. Oh, 1 week out, you're never gonna get a refund on that. Oh, the guy who, like, I'm going to Hawaii tomorrow and I don't have a room booked. No, suddenly you understand how refund policies work. Also, and this is as somebody who worked at a travel agency, if you're going to Africa, you bought the travel insurance. You don't go to Africa without some sort of safety net. And in that travel insurance is definitely cancel for any reason.
Yeah, and, you know, and maybe, oops, sorry, hitting my microphone.
It's all right, we're passionate right now.
Yeah, but maybe this goes hand in hand with the idea that they're going to a resort and they're not really going there to experience, like the truth. But, like, the idea that if you're traveling internationally anywhere, even before COVID, like, there was, like, you need to get medical records taken care of. There was things you needed to do that, like, you couldn't just on a whim just take, especially a handful of kids with you to a foreign country.
Yeah, these kids all had passports is something that I said, because the trip is still offered in the same Adam Sandler timeline of we're basically going to Africa tomorrow. I mean, they have a week, but we don't see that week, right? We just see them, oh, I'll buy that from you. We're going to Africa.
He's got an in with Dick himself, so I think fast-tracking some passports is definitely possible.
Yeah, I don't. And you know, and it's like, this is a multi-million dollar vacation that they go on.
Uh-huh.
This is not a friggin' Disney cruise, which is still like $7,000 when all is said and done.
For sure. I will say that part of that is covered by the MacGuffin of the idea that his boss was the one that had paid and planned for it all already. So like it's not like it's coming out of his pocket in a lot of ways. I know he says, I will give you money for the tickets, but like there's no indication that he has paid him back in full for this
Oh yeah,
entire
no, and
thing,
I don't think
right?
that, but like, but how much do you think he had to pay? How much do you think, like, and that's where my mind goes to, and it doesn't go there until we see that each of them have their own huge room, and also had apparently booked into a group like specialty week for blended families on honeymoons, and then also they did a bunch of extra stuff. Like they had taken advantage of a bunch of extra amenities as part of it. Like resort travel is again not cheap. It's just it's everything about this movie at every possible turn, it is doing what it can to like keep me removed from it until that one moment of genuine human interaction where I forget everything and then I'm on board.
Yeah, it definitely it abuses the sentimental, bullshit. Like it uses it in a way to kind of keep you engaged when nothing else is working. And so like that's a bit of a that it feels like it's a bit cheap at a lot of moments for me. But if it gets you, it works. If it works for you, it works for you. Like it's so weird because like I am a sucker for that stuff too, and I definitely felt that, but I definitely was able to, with this particular movie, feel that stuff and realize that like this movie did not deserve it, I guess is my point.
Right, and that's why we watched the movies twice, Sijin, because the second time I deliberately did not let myself fall victim to that spell, and we have stuff to talk about there. But you know what? I think it's time that we go for the old reliable, that we look at something new, something old, something borrowed, and something blue in the
Yeah, man.
nominee for entry into our Adam Sandler cinematic universe. So, would you like to go first or second, Mr. John? C. John.
Let me go second. I want to hear what you got for your stuff.
Awesome. That's fantastic. All right, so kicking it off with new, I'm gonna go with Cricket. I believe this is the first time that we've ever seen Cricket in an Adam Sandler movie, or really any movie ever. I mean, you gotta understand what Crumpet is to understand Cricket. And then not only is Cricket shown in this movie, but Dale Stein, noted freaking cricket player, just randomly shows up as somebody who's at the resort for some reason. Is he
I was
on vacation?
literally looking up Dale Steyn, South African cricket player, so I made sure I got his name right as you were speaking. I got it right here, man.
I'm sorry, did I steal yours? I don't
No,
mean
no,
to.
no, 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 no. You didn't actually steal mine. But I was trying to remember who that was as we were talking about just the being out of touch stuff, and the idea being that no, it is none more apparent than the fact that Dale Stein is like the big what do you call it? Athletic like star yet for the middle of this
I
movie
mean, you
because.
say that, but the biggest athletic star they get for this movie is Shaquille O'Neal.
No, because at this point
I
he's
once saw
old
his
man Shaq.
jersey. He's a giant, Seijin.
Isn't he? Hasn't he also been in Grown Ups at this
Yeah,
point?
he's
Am I
been in
wrong?
grown-ups. It's not new.
Yeah,
He's not new.
so
That's
he's
why
not
it's
new as
not
the.
it. But it's just he's the biggest. But I'm talking
But in terms
just
of the new, in terms of the
area-wise.
get, the like, hey, an Adam Sandler movie is filming nearby, you should show up on set for a day. That get is a fucking cricket player, which is not to be offensive to cricket players or Dane Stein or Dave Stein or whatever the
Dale
fuck his
Stein. It's
Dale.
easy for me. It's my sister's name.
Dalen Stein, it's fine. I just he it's the idea being that like that's gonna be the joke of this scene, like is that he is the guy pitching, and like I'm sitting there the whole time going, that is somebody. I don't know who, but that is clearly somebody. So it's after the movie that I go and I look it up, right? And then I'm just like, okay, that's funny after the fact. But in the moment, I'm just sitting there. I ignored the entire dialogue of that scene. I forgot that it was important that he learned how to pitch until the end of the movie, when that becomes like the huge moment at the end of this film. Spoiler, I guess. But like the idea being that that is the moment where he learns to hit a pitch. And then he learns to hit a pitch.
And to be fair, the ball he gets pitched at the end that he hits is definitely a bounce.
I mean, that's a dead ball, right? If a
yes,
ball bounces
that
before
have,
it gets
that
to the
not
batter.
Have counted. Yeah, it should, yeah, it was really wild that that is.
Well,
well
let's
yeah,
be honest.
As I said, he only learned to hit cricket balls.
The umpire is like cross-eyed or wall-eyed, whatever the phrase is for that. It's John Loughran's character, I believe, from Benchwarmers, the like can't see straight umpire, as a joke of all umpires are blind. I don't know. So he probably missed it.
Go.
Is the point? But yeah, cricket is. I'm gonna go with cricket, and I'm gonna see what you say, and then I might have another thing that I want to talk about. But what do you have for new?
Something that we. So this is new, and just to be clear, this is not something I think is present and new for the universe writ large. This is just something new in Sandler's movies that we have not quite addressed yet. But there's a few movies, especially around this time period and going forward, where this becomes a huge trope for him in particular, and that's Daddy Sandler. This is the first time where we see him not as somebody who is forced into a new situation with a kid, and the joke is always never had kids before and he doesn't know what he's doing. Rather, this is a guy that has been raising these children since birth, and he is their dad, he is their father. And we see this in plenty of Sandler movies, again, around this time and going forward, but this is the first time that we've really addressed it here on the show, is him having an established relationship with the kids in the film.
Yeah, that's...
And it lends itself to a lot, to a very different feel to the scenes he has with his daughters in this movie than we've ever seen before. Because you think of, like, Pixels, where there was definitely an element with a kid, right? Mm-hmm. And we've addressed things like Big Daddy and stuff like that in the past. But, like, this is the first time where the kid is... Or Just Go With It is another one we've talked about.
Yeah, I mean, right? Like, that's what I was going to say. I can watch Adam Sandler teach a kid who is not biologically his kid how to do something that kid needs to learn how to do all day long. You find me the YouTube supercut of that, teaching that kid how to swim and Just Go With It, teaching Tyler how to hit a ball in Blended, teaching Brandon to box for some reason. Like, I don't know. It just feels like so that we can have a boxing match moment.
What that is, that is the... weird double move that this movie makes in terms of masculinity, where on the one hand he is trying to show him that you don't need to be a toxic masculine figure in order to be a man, quote unquote, but at the same time displays in that very moment a lot of really toxic masculine tropes about how the only way two men can talk is if they're swinging at each other. Like, it's a wild fucking concept that this movie does on every level. Every time it talks about race, every time it talks about gender, every time it talks about very specifically like the idea of the male gender, sexuality, all of that stuff, it always does this weird move where on the one hand it's saying something very progressive and intelligent and thoughtful, but then like in the next second that's either undermined or underwritten by something that happens on screen or something somebody says. It's just like, what the fuck, guys, we just talked about this.
I mean, it certainly feels in this moment like what he had to do was overload his masculinity sensors in that moment in order to force a reboot of the system.
But then congratulates him and tells him what a good punch it was to the stomach. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's no, it's really weird, because it's not that I disagree with some of the sentiment in that moment of him trying to show him what's going on. It's just the fact that that's the way that he chooses to do it. And in a more complex film, that would be really interesting. In this movie, it's just par for the course. It's never addressed in any way that he himself has his own issues. You know what I mean? Despite the fact that we see it with his daughters, but like, it's never brought to attention that maybe the ways in which he also teaches boys needs to also maybe get a little bit of a shine on it, you know?
I mean, this is the first time that I'm going to say it. I know you're not a big fan of these, as we've mentioned on the Say Report, our other show, but there is a 4-hour cut of Blended out there, and I want to watch it. I want to watch the Blended that, first of all, you say that them going to Africa is not explained. I believe that this is all a setup to get these two together.
Not that it's not explained.
No.
It's that it's not justified.
That's not justified, right? You say it's not justified. I believe it is justified, because Jen and Dick were like, we need to get these two people together.
So are you saying that you think that is something that's in that cut, or something you know is in that cut?
Oh, I think that's something that I would have to be in that cut. But that there's a whole hour dedicated to Jen and Dick. I mean, you don't bring Dan Patrick in for one scene, Sejan. He's Dan frickin' Patrick. I mean, Adam Sandler definitely does.
You definitely do that in these movies. You definitely bring Dan Patrick in for one, too.
But no, I'm just saying, there's so much that is not shown in this film that the film definitely needs. And we'll do that after we finish this whole thing. So one other new thing that I toyed with adding, but I couldn't be 100% on it. It's certainly the first time that it's come up in one of the films that we've watched. Mm-hmm. This is an Adam Sandler film being made in a post-Bridesmaids Hollywood. So there was a lot of humor that is given over to Drew Barrymore that is a little bit more gross out humor.
For sure. It's also a post Funny People for Sandler, right?
Yeah.
So it's also a post Judd Apatow, and not just Judd Apatow existing in the world, but his literal time spent working with him, right? So there's also a little bit of that. And there's no denying that Bridesmaids definitely is fed in a lot of ways by what Apatow brings to the table previously. You know, it almost in a weird way is like a kind of an answer to a lot of Apatow comedies, right? And so to that, like, I think you're definitely right. I think there's some Paul Feig in here. I think there's some Judd Apatow in here. There's some new boys of comedy. There's some Todd Phillips in a couple of moments. Mm-hmm. Like there's some new boys of comedy in this movie that you don't necessarily see in early Sandler stuff. So I think that is kind of par for the course with the conversation we've had before, though, about him knowing how to adapt himself and his comedy and things like that to kind of mesh with his audience. And he doesn't do it in a way where you think, oh, he stole that from Paul Feig. You think, oh, he watched Paul Feig enough to understand that this is how people take in comedy now, and that's how he's going to please his audience. So it's in a weird way, it's a very high pandering, you know what I mean? Like, it's that idea of being like, oh, I should definitely be treating women differently in my comedies, and like learning that lesson for the wrong reasons, not because women need to be treated differently in general, but because he realizes that's what audiences probably want to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's just there's so many moments that in previous films would have happened with Adam Sandler, like Drew Barrymore in the paragliding thing, or Drew
almost
Barrymore
hitting the rhino specifically.
Yeah, almost
that,
hitting
that
the rhino
specifically. Yeah. Yeah.
And drinking the French onion soup and then just like projectile vomiting.
Yeah.
On him.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's not really that, but it's tantamount to it. And it's just something that I noticed, and it really, especially in the Adam Ann series. Because then going forward, when he's with Jennifer Aniston again in Murder Mystery, that doesn't really happen in that film.
No, like it's in a weird way, it's much more toned down. But I think a lot of that is then in response to the move back that a lot of people have done in the last 5 or 10 years since Bridesmaids and all that, a kind of away from that, in that we've, you know, a lot of people have been very turned off by Feig in the last few years because of some choices that were made with him and female characters. See our Ghostbusters episode on the main show. But like, there's this idea being that that he knows kind of how to do that ebb and flow. Like, Sandler, more than anybody, knows how to read what an audience wants to see on screen. And I think that's really evident even here, because as much as we are shitting on it now, and as much as critics didn't like it, again, audience members, 65%, $140 million. It's no slouch of a film.
5 stars on Amazon with 19,000 plus reviews.
Right, right. So like, yeah. There are people out there that enjoy this movie, you know, and I don't even mean to act like I don't. Again, it's definitely a movie that I had fun with while I watched it. But like, if I never had to see it again, I wouldn't cry, you know, like, but yeah, so that was my new is Daddy Sandler.
Daddy Sandler's good. I dig it. I especially dig it in this type of film, in this mm-hmm. environment. So good on you.
But what? I mean, I think of the other movie he had just previously done with this very director, Click, where yeah. that was such a huge part of the story of that movie that he misses stuff with his family because of the powers that he's given. And that is like, that is the emotional punch of that film. Right. And so and so to see that brought forward into this totally makes sense. It's just something that we have not personally seen yet on the show.
Yeah. It feels like a natural evolution of what you're presented in that. And it'll be exciting when we get there to explore it. Let's go old. I'm going to let you go first because I have kind of a grab bag of old things that I can reach out and pull. And
yeah.
So I'll let you have
so
the open
like,
table.
Yeah. So the old was, it would have been really easy for me to like kind of pull some of the references that are all over this movie. Right. But I feel like maybe that's where you're going to go. If not, we definitely have, there's plenty to talk about there. So I think I'm going to touch on one that we, I think only kind of slightly addressed back when we talked about Hubie Halloween, but I think now is like the time to really kind of dig into it is we've talked a lot about the SNL pipeline to get into Sandler movies. The thing that we really kind of, again, we've mentioned it once, but we don't really see it till later in his career, is the Disney Kids pipeline into Sandler movies that we saw, again, in Hubie Halloween. You also see with Cameron Boyce in the Grown Ups films, right? And then in this one, you have Bella Thorne, right? Like you've got these, and are any of the other kids Disney kids? I don't think so.
I'm pretty sure Espen is somebody. Everybody talks about her in trivia, like mm-hmm. it's an actor that you should know from other things. But
let me check.
The name didn't really strike me as anything.
Yeah,
but it.
Oh,
okay.
She's Cassie Lang in the Avengers movies.
Oh, okay.
Right. So that's like the thing I recognize her from. I don't know, like she's been in episodes of TV and stuff like
yeah,
that.
So
but other
I
than
think
that
she had come from TV, like just had something there. Like there was some built in. It was just strange every time, like trivia about the movie. A lot of it addressed her. And in relation to it, and I'm like, oh, like it's unfortunate that that character does sort of feel like the middle child of this whole affair.
Yeah, other than that, there's not really much I recognize her from. You know, yeah. Not that she wasn't. She was, you know, great in this movie. In fact, probably out of the three daughters, the most interesting one to me because of the really weird storyline, but actually really, out of all of the things subtly and well handled in this movie, this girl's weird reaction to her mother's passing, where she just, you know, for all intents and purposes, imagines her mother there. Although I will argue that there are definitely moments where there's magic in this movie, and it might be because her ghost is real. there are just things that happen, and then she's always like, "Nice one, Ma," and you're just like, "Wait, did Mom actually do that? Are ghosts real in this world?"
Sijin, you said the M word. You get me nervous when you say the M word.
I'm just saying we have a stat. Specifically, there is the scene with the wave that's
right.
Early on when they
so
first
the only
there.
The only thing about that is that it there's also a sign behind her saying that it's like the wave pool.
You're not wrong. That's why it's questionable
yeah,
throughout.
True. Right.
It becomes a question. But no, there's so that's pretty grand. So she's really interesting to watch in this movie because of that. But yeah, Sandler, the more that he kind of gets into this kind of family movie vibe, and you know, part of it is because he had just done Bedtime Stories. I think this next year as I think him really going into like the Disney works, but you can see him kind of laying the groundwork before that of him kind of working with Disney kids and stuff, and then finds himself in a Disney movie. And it makes sense when he's getting to this point that like he probably his kids have been watching Disney, and he probably has an eye for talent and says like, we should get that kid, you know, that sort of thing. But also the thing about somebody like a Bella Thorne is that she has spent a lot of her post Disney life doing her best to distance herself from Disney life, as it were, in a lot of problematic ways. And I'm sure the idea of getting to play an older child role in a Sandler film at the time really kind of appeals to that, right?
Especially an older child role in a Sandler film that has a makeover transformation montage.
Yeah.
Like, I'm leaving Disney behind. Peace.
Yeah, it's really weird because on the one hand, the only reason that it feels weird to me is that one of the big things that Bella Thorne is known more for nowadays is her attempts at, I'm not going to hear to pass judgment on whether or not she's successful, but her attempts at things like body positivity and sex positivity and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of the things that are in this movie are feel like early attempts to address those kinds of thoughts,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, I think fail in a lot of ways. Like the stuffing her bra scene on the one hand is really intelligent, but then it's not handled well at all. Like the fact that he can't talk to his daughter about it. And the whole point of the movie is that he needs a woman's touch in order for his daughters to be able to grow up properly is like super weirdly, like a move, like regressive compared to the idea of there being this possible conversation between daughter and father about this stuff. It's just weird that like, it strikes me as weird in a lot of these moments and these scenes with her. And you mentioned like the makeover scene is like a huge one where that is such an old kind of played out trope. And for somebody that is so against that stuff to the point where, like, I mean, you know, we're talking about a person that openly expresses herself on social media as being like, you know, poly and bi and like breaking boundaries. And she goes on to direct like an adult film that she ends up winning awards for and things like that. Like she is so anti-establishment in a lot of the stuff that she does, specifically when it comes to like feminism and things like that. To see her specifically being the one kind of stuck in those old tropes felt really weird in a few moments.
Yeah. I mean, I think they try to make it more about her finally just getting to embrace her femininity, in like her father was kind of trying to raise her like a son, with the fact that he calls her Larry and we're going to bulk you up. He treats her like a son. He does not treat her like a daughter. So, for sure. I mean, I think the usage of "I'm every woman" in that moment is supposed to be that connection between her and Drew Barrymore, that like welcome to the sisterhood of it all. Like, it's not just you've been completely changed, because she's not unattractive as Larry, right? Just to use the terms that the film gives you. In fact, every time that somebody says that is a fugly chick or something like that, it rings hyper hollow, because like it's not one of those moments. It's not like an It's Pat moment to bring the SNL back to it.
Yeah, right.
Like, it's like it's that old Hollywood thing of you only believe that this character is ugly because we have told you that this character is ugly, because characters say this person is ugly.
And I think what happens, and the reason why it starts to feel weird in those moments, is because the ways in which she is dressed, and Espen at the same moment, a lot of those scenes include the two of them, which makes it even grosser, is the idea being that, like, the things that quote-unquote make her ugly are short hair, are overalls, are her hiding her figure in a lot of ways. So, like, in order for her to be the woman she is always meant to become, she has to get extensions, she has to wear a tight-fitting dress, she has to do that, is, like, it's not the message, and I think this is maybe kind of the problem, right, is it's not the message they intend to send, but it's the one they end up sending. And I think that that's what happens a lot with the quote-unquote progressive humor in this movie, is it consistently right-hearted in the ways in which it wants to say one thing, but it stumbles on itself and accidentally says a million other things it didn't maybe think it was saying, but it is. I mean, and then people apply that to Sandler, right?
In that
it becomes the overarching attitude about him, is that he's trying to break down walls and be progressive, but he strikes you as the uncle that maybe isn't getting it quite right when you come out to them, that conversation, right?
Right. And it's specifically that scene where she reveals herself, where it is so much fat shaming with Ginger talking about that she went on 10 blind dates, all fatties, no offense, Jim,
yeah.
Which, like, I mean, is Adam Sandler overweight? Like, he doesn't look overweight to me. He looks average. Yeah.
Like turns to him, like, shoveling food into his face, as if we're supposed to understand that that's always been a character trait for him.
Yeah.
But that's, like, the first time we see him behaving in that way, and he is in no way out of shape for the rest of the film.
Right, so there's that thing, and then immediately afterwards, he starts giving the Jake character, Ginger and Kevin Nealon, I can't think of his character, I think it's Ernie or Eddie, their son, he starts giving him crap about being a scarecrow, and he later calls him Skeletor. So then there's also, like, thin shaming in the same blink of an eye of the film, and it's like, so what do you want people to do?
Yeah.
Like, do you want us to transcend our physical form and exist only as, like, mana in the universe? What the hell? We can't be fat, we can't be skinny. What do you want, Adam Sandler movie? What do you want from us?
Yeah, and, like, the the ways in which makeup is addressed with the younger daughter after she gets done up by the face painter and she sees herself for the first time and freaks out. Like, that's like a really beautiful moment where you can have Drew Barrymore's character being prepared to wipe makeup off this young girl's face because she's got too much makeup on. And you get that really sweet tropey moment of the woman who's not her mom suddenly being motherly to her by helping her with makeup and all that sort of stuff. And it's something that her dad wouldn't have on him. He would not have makeup wipes on him, right? So, like, that is such a great example of those exact kind of tropes being put on display, but in a context that it's not suddenly super offensive in other ways, right? So they're able to still have their cake and eat it too. So it's even worse, those moments where this doesn't work are even worse because of the moments in this movie that do work. It's like there's just enough going on in this movie that it feels like they were almost there, that the fact that the rest of the humor is not is made to look even worse than it was.
Yeah. All right. So for my old, I'm going to go back to an old reliable, something from all the way back on his first album, They're All Gonna Laugh at You. And that's the usage of the word buffoon. And I know that the word buffoon is a word. It's a phrase that's out there. But they said it twice in this film, and I was afraid that if they had said it a third time, like, he was going to show up and talk and say to Adam Sandler, "I bet you got really hairy balls." Like, it just, it's one of those things where, I mean, this film, it is a different Adam Sandler, right? Adam Sandler as a human being has aged and grown as a person, and then to, like, constantly have his character be called a buffoon is such a weird, like, dichotomy for me against the person that he actually is in this film and the person that he clearly was. And then it's accentuated by what feels to me, and maybe I'm wrong, a call out to The Longest Pee, where he is out peeing outside of the tent at another moment where I'm just like, what the heck is happening here? These are references to one of your earliest things in one of your newest things. And you talk about the gatekeeping, and I'm like, there are people who aren't going to get those references. But then if you're the type of person who they're like, we're going to put these references in for the people who've been here from the beginning, they kind of pull you out of it.
Yeah, like, it's really weird.
Like, it, not only does it open the gate for you, it also opens the exit. Right? There's the gift shop. That's that you exit through there. Like, it's strange. And then also, since we're just talking about old, and it's the Drew Barrymore stuff, George, now credited as Georgina from The Wedding Singer, shows up at the very end in the announcement box of the playoff game.
It's weirdly playing the keyboard in the background of the announcer's box,
But also clearly aware of what's going on in the Little League, because they know who Tyler is. And then you have 10 Second Tom show up in the pharmacy, clearly as 10 Second Tom. And what I really want to know is how he got from Hawaii to Connecticut. Which then, the final thing, and the final old, and it's important, not important to the ASCU, which is more what this segment is about, but important to the portion of this that we are currently exploring, specifically the Sandler Barrymore Nebula, and that is the fact that they live in Ridgefield, the same town from The Wedding Singer.
Right.
But in The Wedding Singer, it very much felt like New Jersey, yet in this film, it very much feels like Connecticut.
Yeah, that, I mean, you're talking about a New England town. That feels very kind of same, similar area to me, but like,
I mean, it feels like they live south of the city in something like The Wedding Singer, but north of the city in this film.
Okay.
Especially, yeah. I mean, they're in Hartford County. They probably go to the Hooters in Manchester, the only Hooters in Connecticut. Like, it's like there's just weird thoughts that go through my mind because it's an area that I'm familiar with. And I know that's like me bringing my own baggage to the ride, but it is something that stuck with me.
But the fact that they do reference The Wedding Singer so often, right? The fact that they reference 51st Dates hardcore with 10 Second Tom, like, It's weird because it's building its own little universe within itself, right?
Right, which I believe was my original hypothesis back in the first episode that we released a year ago. Yeah. That, like, I'm fairly certain that these are going to exist as their own thing.
Yeah.
And just sort of like as an Ouroboros or Amphisbaena eating itself.
Yeah.
And now that we've got here, it kind of feels that way.
We get an asshole, though. We do get it. We do get another asshole to be in the evil bad guys.
Oh, my
too.
God. Mark is totally in the League of Sandler villains.
Right.
Like, without a doubt.
It's so good because I love Joel McHale. I don't know. It's I'm a sucker, I guess. Like, so take everything we say for the next few minutes with a grain of salt. But he is so good, and he does the same thing in Ted. Where
he's the same character in the two movies.
He steps on screen, and he's just an asshole. In Ted, he's worse because he is like should be on a watch list in Ted. At least in this movie, like, nah, black girl, you're too good for him. In that movie, he is straight up villainous. But man, the attitude that he has and the role that he plays. Like, basically, his entire note on set is just look good and be smarmy. Like, that's it. And he's just like, that's my life. Like, Joel McHale is like, I'm not doing anything.
Oh, I thought you hired me to act.
But that's like par for the course with these Sandler movies, right? Yeah. Especially if you're only going to be in for a couple of scenes. Is like, we don't want you to do anything more than just have a good time while you're here. And he clearly does in these scenes with Drew Barrymore.
So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give my borrowed first right now. And while I'm doing that, if you could find me Joe McHale's age and an approximation of Drew Barrymore's age, I need to know who's older there. Because that was a weird thing that, like, I couldn't get out of my head watching this movie. Which will bring us...
Do you want the answer, or do you want to do your thing?
I mean, if you have the answer right there, I'll take it.
So he is 4 years older than Drew Barrymore.
He is 4 years older than Drew Barrymore? I would have never guessed that.
Yeah, he is born in 71 in Rome, Italy, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, and she is born in 75, and she's from California. Well, so he is 4 years older than her.
Okay, well, thank you for having that information ready to go. Yeah. Thank you for understanding the esoteric questions that I'm going to ask while we do the show.
There you go.
All right. Moving right along, Footloose and Fancy Free, to Borrowed. It's not the Muppet movie. It's Dirty Dancing. The resort that they're staying at is such the resort from Dirty Dancing. It's kind of uncomfortable. and it's not so much that they're reliving Baby's story from that, but it's the fact that, like, somebody's sleeping with Terry Crews as the Frank Castle of this whole affair. and be it the older Indian woman or somebody else that we're not even familiar with, like, it's very much the resorts of the Catskills that are on display in this movie, which leads me to wonder what the original location was in the script. And then when it comes to Adam Sandler, like, why don't we just put it in Africa? Because I want to go to Africa. Can we do that?
Yeah, it's exactly that, right?
Because it does. It has that sort of charm of that 50s vacation in a way.
I honestly thought you were going to say Havana Nights. That you just felt like it was just that.
Because... I've never seen Havana Nights. I can't bring myself to do it. I love Cuba and I love Dirty Dancing too much to ever see if they'll blend.
Blended. Yeah, man. So with that, my borrowed is the Greek Chorus.
Nice.
I mean, like, it's hard to ignore, right? Like, it is so clearly, and again, I will point out another piece of magic in this movie, because, like, they show up literally everywhere.
They rode a
hot air balloon at the end of this movie.
They took a hot air balloon from South Africa to Connecticut.
Just so they could sing their song above this thing, right? So yes, you have this chorus that shows up the moment that they show up in Africa and is there for the rest of the movie, and it follows them around and just kind of puts a highlight on those moments that we're supposed to really pay attention to. Because I'll tell you what, the lyrics they're singing have nothing to fucking do with anything that's that important. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like they're moving the plot along at all. They kind of represent my biggest issue with the whole, like, African subplot of this entire film, is they are just kind of thrown in there. there as a joke the entire time, and it becomes upsetting at some point.
I mean, if we're going to live in my world where this is all an elaborately designed scheme to get Lauren and Jim together, they were like a magical demon sort of being that were summoned to make sure that they are pushed in the right direction.
Oh, I just thought you were going to say they were like the earth, wind, and fire of this world, and the guy that is the millionaire that clearly planned the whole trip to begin with also paid them to just follow them around.
No. I think that they're summoned because the reason why Terry Crews almost dies is because they are so far from Mount Kilimanjaro, clearly the source of their power.
Oh man. But yeah, I mean, we've
thanks,
talked about
Toto.
The love of old tropes, right? And this might be the oldest one we've ever seen him employ. But this idea of the Greek chorus that we see throughout this whole film struck me as just like this very old tropey humor that doesn't quite work in this film.
If we're going to talk about the Greek chorus in this film, we have to talk about the Tim Herlihy scene, because if there is a gratuitous usage of Greek chorus in this movie, that is pretty much all gratuitous usage of Greek chorus. It is them showing up to tell his son that he sucks at basketball. It's not funny. It goes on 4 minutes longer than it has to. Like, and you say that it's supposed to...
I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing because you're right.
Yeah, and if you're saying that like they show up to punctuate important moments in the film, the important moment that they're supposed to be punctuating is the fact that, you know, Hillary wants to be more feminine. She doesn't want to be her father's son anymore. She wants to be seen as the woman that she is. And it's right after she does like the weird dance basketball thing that feels like it comes from fucking nowhere. Yeah. Like, it's not like a moment where like they tried to dance at the teen club and she like tripped or got like fell over herself. So now she wants to demonstrate to Jake that like I can dance and I can move when I'm in my element, which is on the basketball court. This is another example of why I feel like there's got to be at least a 2.5 hour version of this movie where there are moments that kind of explain the moments that make no fucking sense.
There isn't, but yeah, a man can dream, I guess.
It's fun to dream. Oh, man. And I guess if we're just talking other borrowed stuff, we've already talked about the trope a bunch of times, but it really feels like the whole chorus of musical moments as people watch Bella Thorne and then later Drew Barrymore enter the dining room just feels like she's all that. It feels like the next evolution of Not Another Teen Movie's usage of that trope.
I will say that I really appreciate it in terms of things like age and stuff like that. And this is something that you always have to give credit to Sandler for. And part of it is because he just works with the people he loves working with, mm-hmm. is that he always finds himself with these phenomenally talented and beautiful older actresses that are on screen with him. Is they give that same moment to Drew Barrymore later and that moment for Drew Barrymore works really well because of the setup of earlier with the Bella Thorne stuff. And, you know, like I'm probably missing the forest for the trees because I'm sure that that's upsetting in ways too, in terms of talking about things like tropes and the ways that women's bodies are presented objectively on screen and Sandler films are notorious for that.
Yeah.
But I will say that like the idea of allowing then the older actress in the movie who is, for all intents and purposes, the actual love interest of this movie, like to give her that same moment that they gave to the who must be as a character, please say 18, right? The amount of attention that is paid to Bella Thorne.
She's 15. She's 15 years old. Said many, many times that she's 15. In my notes, many, many times that she's 15.
That, because of the way this movie wants me to be so into that character, it's so upsetting. So pushing all of that aside as a conversation to maybe have in a couple of minutes here. But the idea being that they give that same moment to Drew Barrymore later is an interesting move.
I mean, it's also a beautiful example of comedy in terms of the callback, mm-hmm. and the fact that it's not different songs. It is those same three songs, yes. but just assigned to the different people in terms of how they would react to it. And then, as the sting, that horny Indian woman that we have seen throughout the movie, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the first time I watched, I'm like, oh, wow, this lady's, like, real horny for Drew Barrymore, and then throws her bra at Terry Crews. And then as I watched it a second time, I'm like, oh, she's got a whole story going on.
About like, being horny about in just her being, relationship. And
about just being, I'm here in Africa to get down. That's why I came to Southern Africa, because I want to get down. It's perfect comedy, and I will give it the credit that it's due, which is why I toyed with the she's all that of it. But then as I you can't get away from just how sanitized and just Catskills Resort in the 50s everything about this film is.
All right, man. So I think that brings us to our final category here.
Oh, something blue. And you can go first.
So we've talked a lot about the ways that Africa is portrayed in this movie and stuff like that. So that is definitely one of the things that I have written down here. But the other one, and we've also talked about this, but I really think this is the time to really kind of parse it, is the way that gender is really approached in this movie just leads to so much of the comedy. And it's much sneakier than the stuff about Africa. Like the Africa stuff is toxic and dangerous, but it's right in your face. So it's easy to see and dodge and ignore. It is the way that gender is made a joke of so often in this movie, and the ways in which like even down to the trope of him and Drew Barrymore not getting along together on the first date, and his idea of a first date being Hooters and he steals her beer and he's watching the game and not paying attention to her and that sort of stuff. It feels very like Honeymooners, and like that's just what men do, and like this just be what women do. And then that becomes part of the plot, in that like she needs a man in the house in order to help raise her boys, and he needs a girl in the house in order to raise his girls. You know, like we've seen that. You made the beautiful Brady Bunch reference earlier, right? Like that idea is just upsetting. So the ways in which this movie kind of hides its kind of toxic gender jokes behind a lot of toxic Africa jokes is, I think, kind of really the bluest part of this movie for me.
I mean, the attaching of what you're talking about, right? What you've just brought up, what you've just shined a light on, there's something in this film that I could not get away from. And that is the fact that I don't know if the role that Drew Barrymore is playing was initially meant to be played by Sandler and vice versa. Like, and this is something we can get into later, but in terms of like gender stereotypes and stuff, like it almost feels like maybe he was supposed to be the father of the boys and she the mother of the girls.
I mean, let's get into it now. I mean, like that'd be really interesting. The idea being that like he is helping out with these boys and he's kind of fucking them up and turning them into toxic assholes because he's lost the only female influence in his life, and that would be a interesting, still tropey way to go about it. But at least the idea of being that like needing someone there to kind of balance kind of his grumpiness and his anger, it would be, I don't know, it feels like it would be probably almost the same in a lot of ways,
right? And but I think that's the interesting thing, and where I got like where it came from is that I feel like, again, it feels like there was a script that existed and then it got Sandlerized, right? For better or for worse, however you want to look at it. But it really is one of those situations where, like, the closet queens joke, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't really work with two women the way that it would work with, like, if he were called a closet queen.
Yeah.
It's so, like, that seems like such a forced joke about them potentially being lesbians because they were caught hugging in the closet. Like, it just feels weird. And then it's like, okay, so, like, well, what if to change this up, I'm the father of the three girls and you're the mother of the two guys? And they still have the same problems, right? Like, it's kind of weird that her son is, like, super horny and all this other stuff. And the other kid is just, like, an energy ball, because like nothing that she's doing sort of looks like those would be the outcomes of her actions.
Well, yeah, and a lot of that comes from the idea that it feels like it's very one note. Like, the humor becomes really one note.
Yeah.
Like, what's the joke going to be with this kid? Oh, he's the horny one. Is, like, the whole fucking shtick.
Which really
but then
puts
it becomes
when
really,
he sprays
become,
the fire.
Really upsetting.
Sorry.
Well, yeah, no. That moment when he sprays the fire extinguisher.
Like, at the
like
first time,
upsetting.
It's just like, it's not upsetting at first. At first, it's just like, is a kid messing with a fire extinguisher? That's what you do. And his babysitter is over, like, way in over her head. And then you hear the bath line, and it's like, that's weird. But then when you see that he has a centerfold with that woman's picture on it, him
yeah.
suddenly covering
becomes,
her in white goo.
Yeah, it becomes really creepy and becomes upsetting obsession. Like, if he was horny, and he was horny for just everybody, that would also be upsetting, but, like, at least not creepy. I don't know, man. There's no way to really make
yeah,
this
we,
joke
I mean,
work.
We can
really
push this one off if we want to, but, like, it's weird that they kind of give him the Oedipal complex in terms mm-hmm. of, like, I love my mom and nobody can take my mommy from me. And then also he's obsessed with, I mean, what is again sort of a matronly figure in the babysitter, but like it doesn't jive. It's like all in search of the joke.
And he never learns anything.
Right. He doesn't.
He never,
yeah. Because at the end he goes to hug her
yeah.
and
he kiss her. He
yeah. He goes
up
to kiss
her.
Yeah.
Kiss her.
I guess like I tried to block that one out. There were so many good things happening at that moment.
No, he straight up tries to assault her, and she throws him to the ground, and like, good for her, but, like, he doesn't learn anything at all by the end of this movie in terms of that. So that's the other thing, is, like, is it feels one note, and it feels like it's supposed to be, like, a quote-unquote flaw in his character that is that we're supposed to realize this is something that makes him not a good kid. And then he never doesn't not do that. Like, it's really weird. Like, he doesn't learn anything by the end of this movie. Yeah, the way that gender and sexuality in this movie are addressed and worked with and joked with and played with are here's what it is. The marketing for this movie told you right away, this is a movie about Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore going to Africa. There's going to be some Africa jokes. You're probably not going to be into it. Don't come see this movie. On the other hand, if you were okay with that, if some people think if that was like you're like, fine, I'm on board, Adam Sandler, let's do this.
That's the toll to see Adam and Drew again.
You showed up. And then you were slapped more with this entire concept of like male and female roles in the world and the ways in which families come together and all this sort of stuff. That is what makes it so much more dangerous to me, is that you look at the box, you read the tin, you see the trailer, you know this is going to have some problematic stuff to say about race. And then you can quote unquote prepare yourself for that, whatever that means, whether it's throwing that movie out the fucking window or putting it on with an understanding mind of what you're getting into. You didn't know what you were getting yourself in for was going to be all of this shit about the ways that gender are addressed in this movie, and that's not fair. That is when it becomes super upsetting to me.
Yeah, I gotcha. That is certainly blue. And weirdly, for maybe the first time since the show's existed, leads into what I wrote, which is Drew Barrymore ends up going with the Tampax Pearls Blue Package, which is
so
lighter flow coverage.
Yeah, so this was the scene that I thought of when you said Bridesmaids and about how a lot more of the gross out humor, quote unquote gross out, I want to put quotes around that because
yeah.
I don't believe that tampons and that sort of stuff are gross. But the idea being that adult conversation, you would not have seen a woman having that kind of conversation on screen, especially that ended with her saying like, bump it, like the joke at the end of that, a phenomenal callback to his bullshit with the porno mag. So like, I actually really appreciated that entire moment for her, and one that I firmly believe would not have existed if not for the presence of a Paul Feig bridesmaid-esque atmosphere in comedy at that moment.
I can agree. I mean, that whole sequence, the sequence in the drugstore, as much as I say this movie doesn't grab me until the 52-minute mark, it is just two old friends having fun with one another.
Well, and even to that point, the opening date is really, you can tell that this is two people that we've seen now on screen twice before being lovey-dovey and them being so opposed to each other. Like, yes, 51st Dates definitely gave us a couple of scenes where they were like meh with each other. And there was definitely a moment in Wedding Singer where they separated, but they come back together. So seeing them kind of pushing each other away is not new, but the veracity with which they are doing it is new, right? And the movie knows that. So, like, that is actually really interesting to watch. And then, like you're saying, the stuff in the drugstore feels like, hey, this is just genuinely just two people that love working together. And that is where I think the heart and soul of this movie really comes down, is that at the end of the day, these are two people that we have seen on screen work before and we love, and they love working together. This is a movie that we should all love experiencing. And the problem is they shoehorn in a bunch of stuff that has nothing to do with the two of them, and it messes the whole fucking thing up. If you just removed the entire Africa subplot and this was just about their problematic relationship, even with the gender stuff, you could then argue that like, that's the problematic aspect. But the marketing would have focused on that. You would have known going in that was the story. You would have understood, like, this is what they're going to explore. And maybe they would have gotten in some type of rework and some type of conversations on set. Maybe different things would have happened in those moments if they had focused on that. The problem is that that's where their bread and butter is. And they spend the entire time fucking filling up on the never-ending salad. What are you doing?
That salad, man, it's intriguing. People do it. You know what else I want to talk about? Just because we're talking about the drugstore? The Poise joke? When that product is clearly called Poise?
Yeah.
But he reads it as Poise and is like, that's a little close, guys. To what, pussy? Like, what the hell?
Yeah, well,
you have three daughters, Zeto.
Yeah, but he's a man. His penis stops him from ever taking in anything that has anything to do with women.
Yeah, it's just that. But then also, I will give just like one thumbs up. I'll flip a coin to my blended here in terms of Connecticut is known for those small, independently owned and run pharmacies. Like, that's when I'm like, they are definitely in Connecticut. I mean, like, unfortunately, like, in Rhode Island, I can't think of any of the ones I used to go to are kind of gone.
Yeah, but all got either bought up by, like, CVS or Walgreens, right?
Yeah, but Connecticut, they're still everywhere. And it made me happy to be like, oh, yeah, Connecticut, that's, like, one thing they got going for them. Nice job, Adam. Nice job.
Yeah, I love, in that moment of talking just about the two of them being great together, them having that conversation in front of the tampons is really funny. And then him throwing her under the bus a moment later is really funny as well. Like, again, it just comes down to just watching the two of them be friends on screen. And in this case, knowing that they're friends and seeing them try so hard to not click, like the movie overly wants us to know how much they belong together. The fact that they finish each other's sentences, the fact that they both own the same car, the fact that in that moment when they leave the pharmacy, they both open their fucking, I was going to say their garages, their trunks at the same time, right? Like, we're supposed to have all of these moments where it's clear they're literally...
Everyone knows that they should be together, right? Except for them.
Exactly, right. Like, the movie wants us to be in on that. And I'm fine with that, if that's your movie. But don't tell me that your movie is about them getting forced into a thing and going to Africa together and then not have that happen for 30 minutes. And then also, what is the entire last 10, 15 minutes of this movie?
Where when suddenly they're back they in Connecticut?
They just leave Africa all of a sudden. I didn't know that happened.
Dude.
Like, that moment happens where they don't kiss and then a plane flies over. And I was just like, wait. Do they go back to Africa at some point? Why aren't they still in Africa?
Why are they out of Africa?
It's such a weird... So, like, you wanted me so bad to believe that this movie was all about them getting stuck in Africa together, and that was the whole story. And that's literally just set piece in the background for maybe 40 minutes of your hour and 40-minute film.
Yeah, it's a choice, to be certain. All right, so I think we can put an end to that, the new old borrowed blue. And that makes me happy, because there's a thing I need to say about this movie. There's a thing I need to say... And I'm excited to hear you either tear me down or agree with me on this. My biggest issue with this film is how bad a parent Drew Barrymore is. Compared against, like, him as a parent. Like, sure, he might not be connecting with them as women, but as far as, like, being a parent goes... He seems to have pretty solid relationships with all three of his girls. Where, like, yeah, Drew Barrymore seems like, I have no control over my sons.
Yeah, there's as much as they go out of their way to give Drew Barrymore a lot of the Sandler-esque comedy in this movie, they don't give her any of the emotional build. So as much as this movie wants to, and again, this is that double move that, that I'm talking about, is as much as this movie wants to show us how progressive it is in its portrayal of women in comedy by allowing her to have some of the jokes, it doesn't seem to understand that that also means that she should carry some of the emotional baggage as well. So like, on the what's really interesting about that is how much emotional baggage we were willing to see her carry in The Wedding Singer and 50 First Dates. I mean, I gushed at the end of 50 First Dates about how much work she puts into that character and about how she kind of anchors a rather unbelievable figure in a comedy movie. Drew Barrymore goes above and beyond and anchors that film in some type of reality that makes you love it. In this movie, and maybe this is part of the reason why it's not well received, is she's never given those moments. They're so quick to try and give her some of the funny that they never give her any of the heart. And that is so upsetting. And it kind of misses the point of a lot of what things like Bridesmaids and stuff were doing. Like,
yeah, they give her all of the comedy, but none of the charm.
Mm-hmm.
It's strange. It's one of those moments where there's a way to recut this movie to make it a horror film, and Drew Barrymore is the killer.
I don't know if it goes that far, because I also don't think Adam Sandler is as great of a parent as you seem to be making him out to be. He's a good parent, but he's a guy in over his head. And she is just a bad parent.
Yeah, she's a bad parent.
Yeah, she's just a bad parent. So, like, I think that
like him, he's trying. Not putting in the effort, it doesn't seem like.
And it's not by anything that Drew Barrymore is bringing to the role. It is literally this character on screen just feels like, well, I was never intending to raise children, and so I need to find somebody else to raise these children. Whereas, like, Adam Sandler's like, I was never intending to raise these children alone, but I would like to find someone to help me raise these children. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
like
I know exactly what you mean. It's
very, very different.
It's very disparate. And where I say that she's the killer is one of those situations where, like, oh, I'm stuck in this terrible situation where I have to raise boys. If only I had girls. If only I had had girls.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of the tropiness of that, it really does lend a lot of credence to what you were saying earlier about the idea that maybe Sandler originally had that role. Maybe they were reversed, right? Is the idea being that the emotional connected parent was the mother. Seems like that would really be more the way to go. If I was making a trope-filled love fest, right?
Right.
Like, I feel like that has to be the way that it's portrayed, but...
Okay, here is the thing that I need to address, and I need to address it, because I have said so many times, and it is the thesis statement of this episode from Devin Decker, is that I don't care about this movie until 52 minutes into it, right?
Yeah.
And that's something, that's an important distinction that I am making there. But then, once I start caring about this movie, the shit that Drew Barrymore does is way off the reservation. She is acting like a sociopath. Like, she just, like what she has with Lou, right? Where she's like, I'll take your kid to the bathroom, right? Like, I get that one. It's one of those situations where, like, Mommy, I want to go in the boys' room. I've never gone in the boys' room with, like, single mothers in movies and television, right? It's right. Lou like, I'd really like to go to the girls' room. I'd like to go with a woman, please. And she's willing to do it. And that's, like, the first time that they sort of trade kids, right? And he gets to harness the energy of Tyler, and she gets to have this, like, emotional moment with Lou where she saves her makeup and everything. But then, where Drew Barrymore, completely of her own volition, approaches Hillary and is like, let me take you to the salon and give you a makeover and let me pay for it. It's just like, I mean, that's a nice thing to do if it's a kid you know. She's basically a stranger to you. I don't know. And then, like, what she does with Espen, where, like, she acknowledges that, like, the way that she's grieving her mother is to make her essentially her imaginary or invisible friend. And then, like, she brings passion fruit for both Espen and for the mom. And, like, that, like, makes a connection there. Like, that's nice. But also, it's, like, a weirdly calculated thing that feels like it just, it only exists because the script says so. Like, she doesn't ever really have that moment, right? They never really talk about it. There's just like that knowing glance when she's like, no, my mother is sitting there to her son.
Yeah, I mean, it goes kind of hand in hand, though, with the ways in which, like Sandler fat shames his oldest daughter and, like, the ways in which he treats her oldest son. Like, you mentioned how weird it is that he decides out of nowhere to just take him boxing. Because, again, like, the words you just said, it feels like that only happens just because the script says, and then they fight. Like, it's like, wait a minute, why did we suddenly end up here? So, like, you're not wrong. Those moments are definitely there for Barrymore, but they're also there for Sandler. This movie really does no favors to either of them in terms of the parenting aspect.
I guess where the issue
he
is,
he gets the emotional moments with Espen. Like, that's the saving grace for Sandler in this movie.
I guess where I'm coming from is that it speaks to what we had discussed earlier with, like, she's just like this comedy one note bad parent. Yeah. Where, like, he has the charm still. He still has that Adam Sandler plot armor on him.
Right. But so, we know what makes it worse is we know for a fact she can do the emotional stuff as well as the comedy, because we've seen in two other movies where she is on screen beside him doing that stuff. So, like, it hits a little hard, right?
Yeah, so it's strange. So, like, but those moments that you talk about where, like, why he's suddenly boxing with the kid, the moment for me where it's like, why are they boxing, is the fact that they go boxing. Like, they at least, and maybe it's because of Adam Sandler and the affability of his character in the film, like, it seems like those natural progressions that when left alone with this kid who, like, seems to be a ball of energy, they would try to ride ostriches, right? Because, right, like, what it needs to be is that his mother is so afraid that he's going to get hurt, despite bashing his face into every fucking wall she walks by with him, that she won't let him, like, go out and try experiences, which is where, like, the rebellious streak that he has sort of comes from. And rebellious streak in huge air quotes, because really he's just energetic and he's not being given the opportunity to work off that energy, despite the fact that we see him twice knocked out as if he expelled all of his energy somehow. Like, it doesn't jive in any way, shape, or form. But then, because of that connection with the ostrich thing, like, it would kind of make sense where he's like, I'm going to teach you how to play baseball because I work at a sporting goods store. Like, there's enough there to sort of support all of the things that are done by Adam Sandler's character. And Drew Barrymore's just constantly feel like it is only happening because the script dictates it, and the script has not really given any sort of, like, move into it.
Yeah, no, I'm not gonna sit here and defend this movie, because you're not wrong. Like, it fucks it up left and right. I just think that there's definitely plenty of evidence that Sandler is also just kind of a shit parent.
Oh,
and I think it just comes down to, like, that again, that old tropey humor that it's just funny to see bad parents, right? To the point where now don't we have, like, bad moms and bad teachers and all sorts of bad.
Yeah, there's all sorts of bad movies that happen after Bad Santa. Yeah. I don't know. I guess it's just one of those situations where it's so apparent, and it, like, and all those moments can be changed if Bella Thorne, right, which would make a lot more sense, is the one who approaches Drew Barrymore asking for help. Like, it's the fact that Drew Barrymore comes to her and is just like, let me give you all of this assistance, completely unprovoked, that it's like, it's a little weird that it's coming that way. And in the real world, lose instant connection to her as her new mother would end in tears.
Yeah, like, it's weird. The connection that they form with this woman over a few days in Africa is really upsetting. I mean, even Espen at the moment, at the end where she's just like, I don't want her to go. And he's like, well, your mom, we have to let her go. And she's like, I don't mean her. No, this other woman.
It's specifically, I miss her, is the line that said. And like, well, yeah, it's okay that you miss your mom, and I get it, and that's why you do this whole thing that you do. And then, no, I miss the woman that we haven't seen for a day.
Yeah, we don't have to lose her too, do we? And it's just like, oh, whoa.
Whoa, okay, oh. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's...
No, this movie forces a lot of feelings on its audience, and that's not fair to an audience. You know, it's another reason why I'm sure a lot of critics probably didn't appreciate it, is because this movie is telling you how to feel in the moment about these things. And sadly, in a lot of ways, it works.
It works! It's like, it tells me how to feel, and I feel that way. Like, kudos to everybody who worked on the film for getting the emotional reaction that they set out to achieve. You do it. Congrats. A round of applause. And I guess the last one, because it's the last thing, and it's related to everything that we've been talking about, is her singing probably one of the best known songs from history, not just cinematic history, but just in the world. And that being like this instant connection that the three girls then have to her, because that's the song our mom used to sing. Like, it'd be one thing if it were like some obscure song, like how does she even know it? But when it's just Somewhere Over the Rainbow, like, I don't know. And that's the final moment, is that like she tucks in Lou, and that's because Lou, as maybe 6 years old, right? I can't imagine she's older than six at this time. She's attending school because that's why he's doing her hair at the end with the garbage twist ties, is that she's going to like wacky hair day at school. So she has to be like 6, 7 years old, right? So her asking, can she put me to bed, please? Like, that's fine. But then after she puts her to bed, we're again completely unprovoked. She goes and gives Espen a kiss on the forehead. Like that made me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, like I said, man, you're not wrong. It's
I know, I'm not like looking forward. It's just
the way that this movie wants you to feel, the way that this movie forces you to understand what's going on, is uncomfortable in a lot of moments. It's, dare I say, not a well-made movie.
And you know, it made three times its budget internationally. So,
and this is why people feel the way that they do about Sandler nowadays, is because a movie like this can come out. All of these things that you and I have talked about for the last hour and a half are totally legitimate. It's just that at the end of the day, still brings in $150 million. So people can't stop him. And I think that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. There are people out there that feel like if you make this kind of movie, you should not be allowed to keep making movies. And I don't agree with that necessarily. I think that you should definitely like come to terms with the kind of person you are, be better in future films, and there are a lot of ways in which he does not get better, especially in terms of the ways that like race are portrayed and things like that. But then, you know, there are ways in which he does, you know, the ways going forward in which women are treated in his movies are definitely change over time and things like that, and even race in some of his later work and some of his more indie work. It's just that he knows at the end of the day that he can go out there, shit out of Blended, make $150 million, and then that'll let him do things like, you know, in the same year, this is the same year that we see, not Sandy Wexler, what's the other indie, The Cobbler, is that the other one that's 2013?
The Cobbler's 2013, so this is 14, so I believe it's Sandy Wexler that comes out this same year.
Yeah, but that's what allows him to do these kinds of things, you know, is exactly that.
That and that fat deal with Netflix. Like, it's, and kudos Cobbler to you.
Is later this year. That's what it is.
It is this year?
Yeah.
God, I could have sworn that was a 2013 movie.
Is also this year, too, by the way. And he also has a small role in Top 5, which is the Chris Rock one.
I loved his role in Top 5. I don't know how we're ever going to address it on this show, but, oh.
Yeah, I know. So it allows him to kind of to do that sort of stuff, is making a movie like this. And, you know, it's not that it's an excuse for, you know, old white dudes to keep making shit comedies that upset everybody. Like, they should not be allowed to continue making movies the way they have been making movies. And Sandler needs to figure out new formulas. But as we've discussed with later films of his, like Murder Mystery and stuff like that, he definitely moves in different ways. Blended just... It doesn't work critically, but works financially, and I don't know if a man learns a lesson from that.
That is beautifully put. Is there anything else you want to discuss or add to the discussion before we pass
judgment
and see? No, but
I'm going to put a point on this as a movie that consistently, you know, tells and shows and tells again, is that my note page for this, and it was only one page because there was not much going on in this movie that interested me, at the end of it, I scratched out literally every note I had and wrote "Why Africa" on top of it all. I just don't get it. It is just the entire main conceit for this supposed movie is this trip to Africa, and it leads to nothing. It is one of the most upsetting things I think we have seen in a Sandler movie in terms of just unnecessary.
Gratuitousness. It's gratuitous. It's gratuitous. And like the question that I have that I wrote, even my first, like, I try to watch the movie completely just as a movie and enjoy it before I look at it more critically. And even during that viewing, I wrote down, do people like vacation in Africa? Is that a thing? Like, because it seems like such a weird thing to be
rich
like.
White people do. I mean, see, that's what I mean. It's like there is something to be said about the ways that this movie could be seen as a critique on that type of literal, the phrase for it is cultural tourism.
Right.
Like the people out there that drop $5,000 for them and their kids to get to go to Cancun and stay in a resort that is completely jam-packed to just the brim with all sorts of different shows that they put on, and all of the wait staff are going to be quote unquote natives. Like there's all of this problematic shit that they put on display at these places, and people pay good money to go to those things so that they can then say for the rest of their lives that they spent some time in Mexico, so they know what it's like. And you don't, but that's the thing, is that is what this place is selling. Is it selling that ability to you, that privilege to you later on to talk about how you've spent that week in Africa and you got to see the animals and you got to talk to the people of that area? And it's like, no, you didn't. Like, they were putting a show on you for the entire time. You were never in danger. The safari was all like declawed lions and all that shit. Like it is all made to just be an illusion for the rich white folks, and that is definitely something that exists in the world. This movie puts that on display and then never critiques it.
There's the one critique, and also a lovely callback to Happy Gilmore, where he thinks that he's being attacked by crocodiles. And then Gome is just like,
yeah,
no,
yeah,
those are fake, they keep away the baboons.
Yeah, and that's funny, and that is all for the joke. That in no way makes me think the entire thing's an act, because that guy is still so nice to him. Like, imagine if he had like jumped in the water and got saved by a bunch of staff guys, and then there was a scene of him like behind the scenes with the staff guys telling him what an idiot he is for thinking any of it's real. Like, that is the way that scene goes if it wants to be progressive and funny. But that's not what happens.
That scene is. You put a zebra stripe in my pants,
he literally wants to be able to make the joke about poop being a zebra stripe in his underwear. That is the point of that scene.
Hey, what happens in Africa stays in Africa, right? I've never heard it before. It's just so like, I can't imagine Africa as a destination for that type of thing, right? Like, for the family vacation to Africa just seems so off base.
Well, I mean, we didn't even talk about the timing on this movie in terms of culturally, like, isn't this around the time where isn't it Don Jr. or somebody like that? Somebody gets caught, or the dentist gets caught like killing a lion.
Little bit later. It's a couple of years later, but yeah.
But the idea of the rich white guy going on safari paying thousands of dollars for somebody else to kill a wild animal that then they take a photo with and claim that they, like, that's been going on forever, right? And so, like, there's also something to be said about how that could possibly be part of it too. Not just the idea of, like, resort tourism, but the idea of literally African tourism for rich Americans who use it as a way to talk about, like, I mean, you made the joke, but, like, going back to really get to get in close with the cradle of civilization, to become one with Mother Earth. I hunted down this lion for 5 days and then I shot it and killed it with my own bare hands. And it's like, no, you didn't. There was a team of 10 dudes that went ahead of you, did it, and then you showed up on the last day, camped for one night, bitched about the mosquitoes and flew home the next day. Like, you don't get to act like that. Like, that is definitely something that, again, like, you could be aware of watching this movie, but this movie never asks you to be aware of it.
I don't know. This is so strange. This movie is so strange in just so many ways. And then there's a band of monkeys dressed as Hooters girls playing Careless Whisper.
I missed the point. Why were they dressed as Hooters girls?
Because he was...
Did somebody say something?
He was recreating their first date. But was okay. Going to do it right this time.
Okay, so there was someone that was aware of the Hooters context that put them in Hooters outfits. I somehow missed that and was just like, why are there randomly Hooters baboons?
Yeah, it's because...
By the way, because I watched this movie twice this week.
Yeah, both times. It kind of comes from nowhere. Like, just the one baboon dressed as a Hooters girl to bring them the beers, that's enough. You don't then need them... playing Careless Whisper. Like,
I even would have been down with a joke about the monkeys being trained to play Careless Whisper. I'm down on that joke. Why did they need to be Hootie's girls as well?
Yeah, I don't know. And of course, Friends listen to Blended Love in the Dark. What? Sorry, it's just there's so many Happy Gilmore references in this movie.
Yeah.
He rides a damn bull, Seijin. Which I guess brings us to, is this part of our Adam Sandler cinematic universe?
I see a lot of potential for it to be, and nothing that really says it isn't. Is there anything that stands out as a definite no-no?
So, this is a first for us, where this film made me wonder if maybe we have to reevaluate 50 First Dates.
Because of 10 Second Tom.
Of 10 Second Tom. Mm-hmm. It's one of those situations where if this film is in our Adam Sandler cinematic universe, if we put this amongst the stars in our universe, then retroactively, I feel like we have to put 50 First Dates in there.
I would throw a monkey wrench into that, and don't pardon the pun because I meant that one too, is the idea that maybe this is 10 Second Tom of this universe, because as you so rightly pointed out, this is a 10 Second Tom in Connecticut. This is a different Tom than our Tom, who is at a facility in Hawaii, and I don't think would ever be given the clearance to leave that facility, let alone drive himself to a pharmacy to pick up his own medicine.
That's a wonderful point. Using 10 Second Tom as the linchpin of why it can't be in there. I mean, I was going to say that because one feeds the other and one is not there, it sort of becomes this isolated sort of spun off parallel universe of something that exists within the universe, because there's so much from The Wedding Singer that feeds into 50 First Dates. And then even this movie, right? They completely switch the driving to declare his love for her. And then there's the ex at the screen door saying, no, 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 we're getting back together. It's Linda and Wedding Singer. It's fucking Mark in this one.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful, and it evokes all the same emotions that you get from The Wedding Singer. And it's handled really well. But it just, I don't know. I'm not comfortable with putting this one into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. Is where I come down to at the end of the day.
I gotta say, man, so far I have not heard a convincing argument of why it's not, other than you're not happy about it.
I mean, there's the thing, but it's because of 50 First Dates. But if you can reconcile for me how we can leave out 50 First Dates but include this one.
Well, remember,
I was kind of
on the fence about 50 First Dates to begin with. I mean, at the end of that movie, I kind of came away from it saying that there's a lot of things that don't lead to the right conclusion. But I was not completely sold on that at the beginning of our conversation. And I'm not saying that we need to revisit 50 First Dates. I'm pretty comfortable with the fact that we decided at the end it doesn't fit. But if there's enough in that movie that kind of made us question, if that movie was so close to the edge, I was questioning it up until the last minutes of our recording last time. This movie's on the other side of that line. It is more than enough over that line for me.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's the magic, there's the comfort. It's all
there's
about
the
family.
There's the
villain. Like, no. Yeah, no, I guess that's it. I was having difficulty reconciling putting this in there when we didn't put 50 First Dates. But this one definitely hews more in line with what an Adam Sandler cinematic universe film is as we have defined it up to this point.
Where, and I think more to 50 First Dates' credit, that it doesn't find itself depending so much on Sandler and his history carrying that movie, that so many people love it to the point where people that are not normally Sandler fans love it. Whereas Blended doesn't meet that, right? And I think it's because it depends so much more on your love of Sandler coming into it. Like I said, the joke in the first 20 minutes of this movie is him and Drew Barrymore not getting along. But that joke is only really funny if you're there for the Sandler and Drew Barrymore that you've seen and loved before. that joke only makes sense if you're there because of past movies of Sandler's that you've come and seen. You know what I mean? This movie, in a weird way, invites itself into the universe in a way that the 51st Dates was like, I don't need to go to that party. I'm good. Like, I'm going to stay home tonight. This movie's like, fuck that. I'm going out and getting tanked.
Yeah. You know what it is? It is, I think it might be the Frank Caracci of it all. I think that Peter Siegel being the director of 51st Dates is what precludes it from entry into the cinematic universe that we've defined and are currently defining. But then once you have Frank Caracci, he is on board and he is willing to drop this into a place where it exists alongside everything else. Even those references to Happy Gilmore, they're not like, because I've had people say to me, well, your whole reason for keeping 51st Dates out of it, and specifically my reason, is that they all do the Happy Gilmore swing, and then nobody references that, like, there's somebody who does that swing or, like, or that. And that's sort of what kept me from indoctrinating it into our universe. And their argument was, just as easily, those people could be mimicking something that they saw on TV. And I'm like, that's true, but it doesn't feel that way. Where all of the references to Happy Gilmore in this film, from Endless Love being played to Tyler riding the bull after he wins the ostrich off, they just feel like these are references to the oeuvre of Adam Sandler films.
Yeah.
They are not specifically references to a character, where that moment, because of the dismissiveness that Adam Sandler is showing about the Happy Gilmore swing being used, feels like it's like, this one is different. This movie is not part of the other stuff.
Sure, that moment is Sandler taking a stand and saying, I am separating this from that. And this movie is instead him spending the entire time hoping that we still remember those old movies. You know, it shows a real difference in the place that he's in his career.
Yeah.
Making that movie versus making this one. In that one, he's trying so hard to escape that history. In this one, he wants you so bad to remember that history.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's something that, thank you. I knew that. I mean, that's why we do the show, right? Essentially, we do the show so that we can work through these issues of, like, what would or wouldn't exist in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, and finding those ways to reconcile putting Blended in there when we don't put in 51st Dates. The stuff in 51st Dates seems sort of surface and, like, I'm really just trying to get you to invoke memories of The Wedding Singer. And when these two together were together before, from her driving a yellow vehicle to the Thompson twins and Spandau Ballet, where, like, Blended, we want you to remember maybe every Adam Sandler film you've ever seen up to this point.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that.
Yeah. And that is definitely a mark of a shared universe, which is why I am happy to say, welcome to the ASCU, Blended. You've earned your spot, for better or for worse.
Let's fly this one up to the rafters, man.
Oof. Oh man, I wish we can. I'm gonna buy an arena just to do that.
Didn't talk enough about Shaq. That'll be my final note. He is, for a guy that's in 2 seconds of this movie, definitely steals the scenes.
What did Africa do to you?
Also, always giving him giant stuff to carry as he walks around, just to highlight what a giant man he is.
Yeah, I was kidding. I was sort of kidding when I'm like, the biggest athlete in this is Shaquille O'Neal. I'm not kidding about the time that Will and I went to a burger place in Cambridge, and they had one of his jerseys on the wall, mm-hmm. and it was like a blanket. Like, it was so big. We'll have to go if you're ever back East Coast-wise, and, you know, we can go out and do things. Because you have to see a Shaquille O'Neal for real jersey to truly appreciate the gravity of that man's size.
Yeah, we'll talk about you. I mean, this is also the first time we've seen Terry Crews, right? Like, in the universe.
The first time that we've approached him in ASCU.
Also, welcome to the ASCU, Terry Crews. It's not the last time you'll be here, I promise you that.
It's also Wendy McLevin Covey's first time.
Does she ever show up again?
I don't know if she ever shows up again. She is very much a specific thing, but it always feels like her connection to this is based on her connection with David Spade in something like Rules of Engagement. So it almost feels like, oh, we can't get Steve Buscemi, but his brother's not doing anything. We can't get David Spade, but the woman he married that one episode of Rules of Engagement, she's available.
Yeah, but I mean, like, no, like, it's got to be intimidating to have to show up and basically have the majority of your scenes just be with Drew Barrymore. Like, I you know, no offense to her, because again, phenomenal actress. I think that the work that she has done, from everything from Reno to Goldberg's, is she probably is one of my favorite television actresses of all time. And when she shows up in a movie, I'm always pleased. But like, kind of, I have to imagine that, like, no, this is Drew Barrymore, who has done two other movies with Sandler now at this point. Now here I am, and every time I'm on screen, it's basically just me and her. It's just gonna be like, all right, time to put your work pants on. Like,
and in a lot of the times, she is the one doing the heavy lifting in those scenes.
Oh yeah, she's all the exposition. She's the one bringing all of the like the point to the story. Like, yeah, it's she. Like I said, she's no slouch in this movie and does not have an enviable position.
The last thing I have to say is he shows up at Drew Barrymore's house to be like, that woman switched our credit cards. And her response is, oh, no, no, no. I have a system for my credit cards. Your system has no bearing on a cashier handing you someone else's card.
I think the joke is supposed to be that, much like everything else in their weird, separate but equal lives, is that her card and his card are the same, probably like gold American Express card or something. So she did get back, because she talks about it being a color coded system.
Yeah.
And so it can't be her card because she has a color system. And it's like, oh, well, funny enough, you probably have the same type.
We have the same gold bank debit card.
Yeah.
They look like Citizens Bank debit cards from 2014.
So not only is her system just fucking nuts, but on top of that, it also has a major flaw in that your cards are not unique, lady. Like, you can get unique cards sometimes, but generally.
Yeah, she said that, and I'm just like, your job is organization, and you just came across like an idiot, because like, outside of the fact that there are a lot of credit cards that just look the same, and the difference is the name, not the color, you freaking crazy person. There's the fact that he's like, the cashier accidentally switched our cards last night. Oh no, I have a system. Your system has no bearing on anything I just said, you crazy woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I just... you know.
Also in Bridesmaids, by the way, as a major role, just gonna point out.
Who?
Am I misremembering that?
Who?
Wendy McLendon Covey.
I believe that she is. Yeah, I think so. I'm trying to think. It's Rose Byrne, the Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, and then
it's her.
Yeah, she's there. She's definitely there. She's definitely the she's like the she's not uptight about it, but she's like, she's kind of the one who, like, acts as a foil to Melissa McCarthy's insanity in that movie.
Yeah.
Is like, oh, that's his sister. That's the only reason she's here. She gets some... And that, so there's an even bigger connection to the Paul Feig bridesmaiding of comedy of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does. It feels like a lot of the comedy is put on the shoulders of Drew Barrymore. And it's interesting. Especially because in so much of these Adam and episodes, I mean, Jennifer Aniston and Just Go With It feels like a prop for a lot of that movie.
Yeah.
So
and you know, so again, like, it's the double move. Really progressive in the amount of work that you see handed to these two women in this movie that is phenomenally handled and gets the job done. They are not just props in this movie, but then everything that happens around them is really tropey and upsetting. Her leaving Dick, and to the point where you question whether or not it's real, right?
Oh, I totally think that she's like, This guy, well, first of all, it can't come from me. I can't set her up on this blind date with Jim. So I'll find some schmuck that she sees at her kid's school, and I'll have him play him up, right? And once they meet, they're so similar, it'll have to work. And then she comes back and she's like, it was the worst date ever. Brought me to Hooters. What kind of crazy person brings a person to Hooters? Which, like, is that enough payoff that, like, his dead wife managed that Hooters?
Oh man.
No, I got the sauce on the side. They'll do that for me here. They'll do that for anybody. If it means they'll get higher tips, they don't give a shit. But then, like, when it doesn't work, she's like, "All right, Dick, I need you to buy a romantic trip to Africa." For all of us.
Okay, we're starting to get into tinfoil hat territory.
Hat territory on this movie for a lot of it. I'm not gonna lie to you, but that's not what this is about. We've analyzed the numbers, and fact is, this is part of our cinematic universe. We welcome it. It sits among the stars of something like Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, Waterboy, Little Nicky. But basically everything but 51st Dates, right? Oh, and Just Go With It. Like, Hawaii. Hawaii doesn't seem to exist in universe right now. if we're going to be just honest about things. So that's our episode on Blended. Seedon, do you want to tell the people about our next episode? I feel like you're the one who's going to be more excited to reveal what we're going to be doing for the next episode.
Well, are you talking about our special that we're doing at the end of the month? Is that what we're
I'm talking about
in?
The fact that we're doing a holiday special, Seijin.
We're doing a holiday special. It's not something that we've never really addressed Thanksgiving before. So we're doing the Thanksgiving classic, Jack and Jill.
A film that released on Thanksgiving exactly 10 years ago.
Yeah, so we're gonna put a little bit of a special together for this one, because we've been doing Adam and we thought for this holiday season, why not Adam and himself?
Yeah, Adam and Adam.
Yeah, so I am excited. I'm excited not because of the movie, by the way. I don't want anyone to get any strange ideas about us somehow coming down on the side of righteousness with Jack and Jill.
Hoo-wah!
So it's going to be exactly what you know it's going to be. But that's part of what makes Thanksgiving good, is you always know there's going to be turkey and stuffing, right?
Right, and you always know that there's going to be an upsetting uncle, right? It really represents everything about the holiday.
Yeah, it's gonna be a fun one, guys, so please come around for that one.
And the really exciting thing about it is that it's gonna be a crossover with our other show, The Say Report. It's pulling double duty. It's gonna be our very special episode. So I've secured Quizmaster Will Fournier to give an Adam Sandler quiz.
Oh, right? Man, the Al Pacino of our group. I'm so excited.
Every time he tries to get out, we pull him back in.
Yeah,
he moved to Australia.
And I are the same person, by the way.
Oh man, Jack and Jill episode. It just got ramped up. The promises, man. The expectations. The Dunkachino.
It's like every Thanksgiving. It's going to be more disappointing than not. Don't worry.
Yes. All right. So if you have enjoyed what you've heard on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, where we have a focused in topic, why not check us out on our other podcast, The Say Report, which is a show about everything. We would talk at greater length about things that are not Adam Sandler, probably Michael Buscemi. I think that Michael Buscemi is something that I'd like to bring to The Say Report. So if you're interested, come on and find us on our other podcast, The Say Report. But if you just want to stay with us for the Adam Sandler stuff, you can always, you know, get us via email. We're on Twitter at the ASCU. We'd love to hear from you. We've done I think this is our 11th movie that we've looked at in the course of the show.
We're getting real close, man. We're getting real close to the end of the year. We're coming up on an anniversary.
Yeah, right. So it's going to be exciting stuff. But we want to hear from you, the movies that you want to do, how you feel about the universe that we're doing. Contact us. That's good. And we'll also listen to you, like, directly. So if you want to yell at me about the fact that I still don't seem to understand the blue part of New Old Borrowed Blue, you can find me on Twitter at Devin D. Decker.
And if you want to reach out to me about how you feel like all of these movies fit into the same universe, even though we keep saying they don't, you can reach me at Siege versus the World.
Yeah, that's good. That's a lot that he just offered you people.
Hey.
So take it. But until next time, please remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good night, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.